From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Face it, we are captivated by stardom, by celebrity icons. Elizabeth Taylor and Marilyn Monroe, the temptresses. Harrison Ford and Tom Cruise, the heroes. Audrey Hepburn and Meg Ryan, the sweethearts. Marlon Brando and Ryan Gosling, the mysterious men. We cling to their celebrity for something more than just entertainment, something deeper. Ty Burr's new book, Gods Like Us, explores our relationship with the stars, the why and how of our adoration, and what it means. He joins us this hour on Point, the strange and persistent power of celebrity. You can join the conversation. Why do we stare, gawk, follow? What's going on in celebrity worship? Are we all celebs now, mini-me's, with our Facebook fame? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is Ty Burr, film critic at the Boston Globe. His new book is Gods Like Us, on movie stardom and modern fame. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ty Burr, it's great to have you here.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
So first off, is this a modern thing? I mean, is it, just since movies? Was this going on? You know, was it Sweet Betsy of Pike was a celebrity or Abigail Adams or Nathan Hale? Or...
Well, in a sense, but the delivery medium that movies represented changed everything. I mean, we've always tried to have archetypes and we've always looked to people and myths. And, you know, if you go back far enough, you have, you know, mythologies.
Achilles.
Right. That people, you know, those were the stars of ancient times.
And they wanted to be thought of, I mean, in the writing anyway, they always talk about being remembered forever,
absolutely.
Being known.
Absolutely. And, you know, the demigods and the gods of Greek mythology, people use those archetypes and those figures to explain life and the world and behavior to each other and to themselves. And sure, you know, in the years leading up to the invention of movies, there were stage stars, there were singing stars. You could argue Jenny Lind in the 19th century.
Yeah,
was, you know,
from my hometown.
There you go.
Wilmington, Illinois.
Yeah. But what you had with the movies was a global delivery medium. Not just photography, but moving figures. Mm-hmm. And not just moving figures, but
not little black silhouettes of George Washington.
Exactly.
Right?
No puppet shows.
Right?
But close up. You know, the thing about movies is that immediately you had the best seat in the house and you are closer to the actor
the
than you ever were before.
The sparkle in her eye, the curve of her hip, his dashing way with the sword, all of it.
Absolutely. And these people seemed both more like you. You were closer, more intimate, and also bigger, more archetypal. So you had to figure out what was going on there.
When movies showed up, did people recognize quickly that something was also happening with this new, maybe new thing called celebrity? Did they recognize that the culture was, falling into some great infatuation with those figures on the silver screen beyond just what we were familiar with from theater, let's say?
Well, the film industry certainly didn't understand. It took them 15 years to figure out that we go to movies to see the people in them. First of all, when you went to see a movie back, you know, in the one reeler days in the early part of the 20th century, you got the title and the company that made it, and you didn't get the name of the star. They did not bill the stars.
It's just a person.
It's just a person. And partially the studios, the early studios, were afraid to bill the stars because they knew that the popular ones would get more money. But they also just didn't quite understand what was going on here. And so what happened is that the audience... and it was the first of the many, many secrets about movie stars that mm-hmm. we wanted to uncover. The first secret mm-hmm. was, what's their name? And so audiences started writing in to the actors and actresses.
Gosh, I'm enamored of that. Can't call them star because they didn't want to treat them as stars yet. But that
right.
actor, actress, who is that?
Right. And, you know, there were actors getting letters saying, please tell me your name. I won't tell anybody. It'll be our secret. Or they'd make up nicknames for them because they were desperate to know something about them.
What did they want to know next? I mean, maybe we're into that unending chain of wanting to know. Now we want to know everything. But what was the sequence?
Well, the sequence was, first, they had to know the name. You know, arguably the first star billed by name, not really arguably, was Florence Lawrence, who was an actress of the time.
Florence Lawrence.
I know, such a name. Carl Laemmle, the man who would go on to found Universal Pictures and mm-hmm. who was sort of one of the first, you know, rebel independents of the early film industry, he saw what was going on. And he stole her from Biograph, the other film studio. She was was known as the Biograph Girl. And he not only promoted her by name, but he put out this fake news story that she'd been killed by a streetcar so that her fans got all upset. And then he put out another news story saying, no, she's okay, and she's going to be appearing in St. Louis.
So they were starting to work it right there.
And that first appearance, public appearance by a movie star, it was a mob scene. It was the first movie star mob scene.
What, she was outside a cinema or something?
No, she showed up at the train station, and there were thousands of people ready to meet her, and they're grabbing at her and pulling at her coat, and nobody really understood what was going on.
Surely the producers, the studios paid attention to that. It must not have been long before they were very carefully cultivating their celebrity star status.
Absolutely, and each studio had its gallery of stars, and eventually you get one who really catches on. You know, Florence Lawrence was popular, but Mary Pickford was a global mania. Her story's a little sad in that, you know, she was popular throughout the silent era. She was popular for 30 years, hugely popular around the planet, but she always played young women and plucky little girls. Mm-hmm. You know, when she was in her late 20s and early 30s, she was still playing Heidi, and she was a very, very smart woman. If she was in Hollywood today, she would be running a studio, and in fact, she helped found United Artists and basically ran it.
Have stars changed? I mean, if Mary Pickford, imagine, is she a star in the model of who today? Lindsay Lohan or Meryl Streep? Or would she be she might be running a studio. Would she be a star?
You know, she was the first. And in the silent era, you see the archetypes we still live with being sort of founded by individual stars. She was the first America's sweetheart of the movies. Mm-hmm. She was, you know, arguably, you know, the first Meg Ryan, the Sandra Bullock, the plucky but essentially moral, good, funny, but tough, but sweet archetype. And people really, really responded to that. And you've seen various, you know, iterations, Mary Pickford version 1, 2, 3, 4, throughout the history of the cinema, as you have with the action hero, the bad boy, the femme fatale. All these things were coined in the early silent era, and we're still living with their variations today.
I mean, that's such an interesting thread in your book. You write about these great archetypes, as you say, the action hero, the bad boy, the femme fatale, the goddess, kind of, and how in each generation, or maybe every 2 minutes now, we pour a new personality into that rather old, in some cases all the way back to the ancient gods and goddesses, archetypes.
Right. They're necessary narratives. They're necessary narratives by which we sort of explain how the world works, how society works, how you can possibly behave, what happens if you don't behave. One of the things I talk about in the book is how Bette Davis created this archetype of this strong-willed woman in a society that was bent on constraining her. And because, especially in the early days of the, you know, up to the 1940s, the primary audience for movies was female, women would go to see what Bette Davis was going to do next.
You can act like that.
You can,
you know,
in the opening shot of the letter, she shoots her lover down in cold blood. Okay, where are we going to go from there? Is she the hero? Is she the villain?
Oh boy.
What happens if you bend the rules, break the rules, play by the rules?
And of course, male or female, these were then, by this point, there was very successful Hollywood stars, which meant they had fame, obviously, but also money. They had glamour around.
They had glamour, exactly. You have that push-pull between acting out various roles and variations on the screen, and the subsidiary world of great Hollywood glamour. So they are larger than life.
Still, necessary narratives. I want to talk about exactly what's so necessary about the narrative of celebrity life. Ty Burr is with us. His new book is Gods Like Us. We've got callers for you. Ty, Jeff in Oklahoma City. Jeff, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make a point that I think a lot of people live lives where they wish they could do what the actors do, and you have to have the plumbers, and you have to have all the people that do what they do. But
sure do.
But everybody, I think the actors took the ultimate risk.
How so?
You know, you look at Christina Aguilera and all those people where it looks like, oh, it's easy, but they sang at malls and grinded it out at you know, just all kinds of talent competition.
Right, and before they got there, yeah. And they could have failed. They could have flopped, and they didn't, you're saying, Jeff. They took that risk.
That's it. You know, as I'm driving to work, you know, I studied theater one time, and I grew up with an actor. I was in a drama 3 class with Jimmy Marsden.
Uh-huh.
And so I've seen him at a bar here in Oklahoma, and I said, you know, congratulations, you've done great. And he said, thanks. And you know, he's the most easygoing, down-to-earth guy in the world. So I don't look at him as a star, but I look at him just as a he's just, you know, just a easygoing guy.
Because you've met him, so you may look that way, but we sure look at an awful lot of these people like stars and celebrities. And thanks, Jeff Ty. Jeff says it's, you know, it's because they took the risk and now they're living the life. And well, if you're the plumber, you're looking at that and saying, okay, I'm a plumber. It's an important job, necessary, but wow, look at that.
Well, Jeff makes a really good point, which actually I explore a lot in the book, which is, you know, we think we buy into the personas of these stars. We buy into the glamour, and we don't really want to think about the hard and often boring work that goes into creating this persona. And we also don't want to think about the real person, the person behind the persona. And
is there one?
Yes, of course there's one. And it may be almost antithetical to the persona. You know, one of the examples I use in the book is that Jimmy Cagney played these bastards on screen, mm-hmm. and he was
gangster,
known,
tough right. guys.
He was one of the nicest guys in Hollywood. Everybody loved him. He was so easygoing. He was, you know, he'd
That's
help
wild.
Out every. So we make this mistake. We like making this mistake that the persona is the person, and we want to sort of get behind the persona to prove that the person behind the persona is real. If you're following me, but often the person is different or ordinary in ways we don't want to know about. And I've interviewed enough, you know, mm-hmm. celebrities in my day job at the Globe that, you know, when you sit down with these people, they're working actors.
But in a way, we're even rolling with that. I mean, you remind us in this era, with all the social media out there, we know more and more and more about big stars very often. Some of them are making actually their celebrity out of that, the minutia of life. We'll talk about Kardashians and reality TV stars and all the rest. Ty Burr's new book is Gods Like Us, on movie stardom and modern fame. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking today about modern fame, celebrity, and the movies, the strange and ferocious power of celebrity. Ty Burr is with us, film critic for the Boston Globe, author of the terrific new book, Gods Like Us, on movie stardom and modern fame. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. They've come in so many flavors. Here's the 1953 film Roman Holiday. Audrey Hepburn stars as a sheltered princess who escapes from minders and falls in love with an American newsman, played by Gregory Peck, in Rome. She imagines what she would do with a day to herself.
I'd like to do just whatever I like, the whole day long.
Things like having your hair cut, eating gelato.
Yes, and I'd like to sit at a sidewalk cafe and look in shop windows, walk in the rain, have fun, and maybe some excitement.
Just ordinary people, says the princess. Of course, she was an icon. Forget about it.
From the get-go.
Here's one more. We're looking at about different flavor. 1986, Top Gun, Tom Cruise plays Maverick. Here he's showing off to his instructor, played by Kelly McGillis.
You were in a 4G inverted dive with the MiG-28?
Yes, ma'am.
At what range?
No, about 2 meters.
What were you doing there?
Communicating, keeping up foreign relations. I was, you know, giving him the bird.
Tom Cruise and Kelly McGillis. Okay. What's going on in the film and beyond the boundaries of the film when it comes to building the persona of a star, Ty?
Well, it's interesting you use those two very distinct examples. You know, we use stars in different ways. We use different stars in different ways. And I talk about in the book how there are certain stars who are singularities. There was no call for them before they sort of popped up.
One of a kind.
One of a kind. Audrey Hepburn is one of those. She was instantly a star, won an Oscar for her first major film. And we sort of—
That moment in Breakfast at Tiffany's and we're all just agog and
right.
done.
Right. And we instantly know sort of who she is, where she fits in the culture. Tom Cruise, I think, is somebody, a very interesting case in that he represents a backlash figure to what was going on in the 60s. Every generation basically kills off its parent stars or older sibling stars and creates new stars that are more relevant and often more real
to them. So what was the turnover here when he slid onto the on camera in that, underwear scene?
Risky Business.
Risky Business,
well,
right.
that and Top Gun really, yeah. you know, sealed the deal. But think about what happened in the 60s where Dustin Hoffman mm-hmm. came in, people who— and when The Graduate came out, the studio executives shook their head and said, this guy's not a star. And all, you know, audiences under 30 went to that movie and said,
this guy is
a star. And we wanted real. We wanted earthy. We wanted people who look like our cousin Melvin. And you go in 20 years from Dustin Hoffman, You know, in the book, I say you go from, from Hoffman to Cruz, you go from Mensch Triumphum to Aryan Resurgent. You know, it's the return of glamour. The 80s audience sort of rejected what had been going on in the 60s and 70s. They wanted happy endings. They wanted glamour. They wanted stars who were not necessarily deep, but who were flashy and appealing. And the thing I say about
Tom Cruise,
maximum charisma, minimum depth.
Let's just think about that with Dustin Hoffman in the background, 1967, with Mrs. Robinson.
Is this your first time?
Is this what?
It is, isn't it? It is your first time.
That's a laugh, Mrs. Robinson. That's really a laugh.
It's nothing to be ashamed of.
Wait a minute.
On your first time?
Who said it was my first time? Wait a minute.
Inadequate? I mean, just because you happen to be inadequate in one way.
Inadequate?
Well, I guess I
don't move.
Dustin Hoffman and Anne Bancroft, so... There he was. The studios didn't recognize it, but the public grabbed him. They said, that is the icon for our time. And then it changed again.
Right. Well, with Hoffman and that generation, we wanted to see vulnerability mm-hmm. on screen. And by the time we get to Cruz, we didn't want to see vulnerability anymore. We wanted, a quick answer, the action hero. We wanted Douglas Fairbanks Sr. again. We wanted Errol Flynn. We wanted somebody to just swoop in and save the day.
So, all right, the flavors that we're looking for change. Do the archetypes change as well? Are some archetypes popular in certain generations or decades,
absolutely.
and then they're out of favor, such as?
Absolutely. Well, in the 80s, you have this return of the action hero, but interesting female roles kind of disappear and boil down to like femme fatale. I mean, in the 80s and early 90s, the femme fatale goes from being Body Heat to Fatal Attraction.
Kathleen Turner in here just a few weeks ago. Boy,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
But then goes from that to Glenn Close and Fatal Attraction. You know, the femme fatale gets shot at the end and the audience cheers.
And then here's another kind, Gone with the Wind, 1939, Rhett and Scarlett.
I never give anything without expecting something in return. I always get paid.
Well, if you think I'll marry you, just pay for the bonnet. I won't.
Don't flatter yourself. I'm not a marrying man.
Well, I won't kiss you for it either.
Open your eyes and look at me. No, I don't think I will kiss you. Although you need kissing badly. That's what's wrong with you. You should be kissed and often, and by someone who knows how.
Hey, yeah. Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh. What about those two? Take these two. What archetypes? What degree of celebrity? What was going on at that moment in our culture?
Two very different things. Well, with Gable, you had, an instant icon, the man's man, the virile man. He shows up in 1931. He's in 12 movies in 1931, the year he pops loose.
Wow.
And the culture just goes nuts for him. Because think about it. It's the depths of the Depression. A lot of the country's out of work. And here's this guy who just walks in like he owns the room. Mm-hmm. And he's big and he's sexy and women flipped for him and men wanted to be him. And he's the king of Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And, for the rest of his career. Vivian Leigh with Scarlett O'Hara, this movie represents something really unusual and in a way forward-looking, because when the book came out, it was 2 years from when the book came out to when the movie came out, and David O. Selznick, the producer, essentially used the casting of Scarlett O'Hara as a way to almost democratically
up. Mm-hmm.
open up the gate of the star machine and say, who do you want to the audience? Do you want it to be somebody from the audience? And there were auditions at colleges in the South, and there were, Selznick had stalkers, women who showed up, saying, I'm Scarlett, and every actress in America was tested, and it was a public discussion in the gossip columns, and, if the internet had been around, it would have been tweeted 24 hours a day.
So they settled on Vivian Leigh. What kind of star, celebrity did she become?
Well, it's interesting. She was a star in England. She was unknown in America. Mm-hmm. So she was an actress. She was glamorous, but she had no baggage within Hollywood and American pop culture.
Was that good?
She was perfect.
They could make her anything?
Absolutely. Well, for one thing, the women of the South were very glad that she wasn't an actress from the North because,
right, at least she was, right. The British were kind of with the South back in the day.
Yeah, exactly. And she actually was exactly what was called for because she came with glamour and star quality but no baggage. So she stepped right into that.
What makes a lasting star or celebrity? They're almost interchangeable, but of course we know they're not.
Nope.
Because now we've got the celebrity for celebrity's sake. We'll look at that. But what makes one that lasts?
It's a very good question, and I think there has to be forethought and action on the part of the star. There has to be. Look at Gable.
You mean it's a project? It's a deliberate project?
Yeah, I think the actor has to be invested in their persona and in giving the audience enough changes so that as the culture changes and the generations change, people still stay interested. Now, the case I use in the book is, well, look at Gable. He basically never really had a second act to his career. Mm-hmm. And he was beloved until his death in the early 60s.
So he didn't change.
He didn't change, but the movies aren't really remembered all that well. They're not that great. Jimmy Stewart was very successful as a young Mr. Smith before the war. He goes off to World War II. He actually flies combat missions. He's one of the few Hollywood stars that saw action. He came back. He'd really seen the world. He wanted to toughen up. And he decided to change his persona. And he starts doing these very hard-edged westerns with Anthony Mann. And he starts working with Hitchcock and making Vertigo, which is a very challenging role.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's really the dark side of Jimmy Stewart. And he's consciously doing this. And he lasted because he tweaked the persona. Consciously. He sat down and he did that.
So he was, but you can take that. I mean, you talk about some actors, actresses who take that so far that they don't have a kind of celebrity persona. Or aren't following Meryl Streep, for example. She's been so many different things, though she's a great star, and I guess she's a celebrity, but I don't see her all the time in the celebrity magazines.
But that is her persona. We reserve for the great actors. You talked about how stars and celebrities are different things, but so are the actors. There are certain actors that we expect that they're going to be changeable from role to role, and that is their persona. Lon Chaney in The Silent Era, Alec Guinness after World War II, Kate Blanchett today, Meryl Streep certainly in the 80s when we went to her. The thing I like about Meryl Streep is that she's had this huge sort of change in the culture. In the 80s, we went to see her movies expecting great drama, serious drama. We weren't going to have a good time.
Right.
We were
going to
come out.
Going
to her movies was kind of like putting on a hair shirt.
Great as the acting was.
As great as the acting was. And then with The Dingo Ate My Baby, the culture kind of turned against her. We want to have some more fun. And you know what? She got had the same response, and she started experimenting with different roles. And when The Devil Wears Prada comes out, and Julia and Julia, and Mamma Mia, she becomes something new. She's beloved.
We've got a couple of those. Here she is, Meryl Streep and Sophie's Choice, Mamma Mia, The Iron Lady.
We went to that church, and I took the glass. I kneeled down, and I cut my wrist. But I didn't die, of course. Of course not.
If I got me, I will be mad. I wouldn't have to work at all, I'd fool around and have a ball.
I will run, just to nip at their heels and to make them reaffirm the principles on which the Conservative Party must stand.
Okay, the great Meryl Streep and Sophie's Choice, Mamma Mia, The Iron Lady. Is there such a thing as being so adept or artful at acting that you outrun your persona, that you don't establish a deep, big celebrity icon persona?
Well, her celebrity is her changeability. Mm. And at this point in the culture, she's beloved by all generations. My daughters, she's one of their favorite movie stars, which would have been unthinkable in the 80s. But we're not interested in who she is off screen. She seems rather sort of happily dull.
Doesn't that make her less of a celebrity? I mean, I know you're a film critic, but put that aside for a second here.
Yes, it does make her, it makes her celebrity moot beside the point. We get what we want from Meryl Streep on screen. And that's the bargain we've made with her. And she's made with us. And there are certain other actors for whom that's true as well.
Well, such as?
Anybody who puts themselves out there as a great actor and successfully convinces us of that. You can take that back to Marlon Brando in the 50s, and there's somebody who became a star, became a new kind of actor and a new kind of celebrity in that he turned against stardom. He pushed it away. He thought it was ridiculous. And his descendants are many, from Robert De Niro in the 70s to Edward Norton in the 90s and Ryan Gosling today and Sean Penn, actors who say, what I'm doing is serious and I don't want to talk about the celebrity. That's ridiculous. That's silly. That's for the fan magazines. And what I do is a mystery. It's this great acting mystery.
The great mystery. Well, look at that. Here's Marlon Brando, 1951, Streetcar Named Desire, confronting Blanche, his wife's sister. And here we have again Vivien Leigh.
Take a look at yourself in a worn-out Mardi Gras outfit. Running for 50 cents or some rag pick with a crazy crown on. Now, what kind of a queen do you think you are? You know that I've been on to you from the start, and not once did you pull the wool over this boy's eyes. You come in here and you sprinkle the place with powder and you spray perfume and you stick a paper lantern over the light bulb and lo and behold, the place is turning to Egypt and you are the queen of the Nile sitting on your throne swilling down my liquor. And you know what I say? Ha-ha!
Marlon Brando, 1951, A Streetcar Named Desire, the anti-celebrity, and yet he became a celebrity. Tyber is with us. His new book is Gods Like Us. Let's go to Jim in Coventry, Connecticut. Jim, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think?
Good conversation, I think. I was listening to that, and some of the stuff I kind of was thinking that it's how much of this should be looked at. Like you were talking about the archetype and how that's changed mm-hmm. or what. And I really don't think it has changed. I think that the same thing that people look for, you know, way back in the old days, like John Wayne, you know, and I'm saying that guy, you can compare John Wayne to Tom Cruise. Neither one of those guys was really acting during those movies, but they were loved. They were great. They were handsome, bold, daring, all of that stuff,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But acting for neither one of those guys didn't come later into their careers, but they both are awesome, right? Everybody loves them.
Sure. They were big. They are.
When you compare those types of movies from, like, Tom Cruise, you know, and John Wayne and those types of movies, and Meryl Streep could be put in that, certainly, as far as great actors and actresses. The difference in movies that I see is that there was something lost, I guess, from the Marlon Brando days and the Bogart days and the Wayne days, where there was a less of the, you know, somebody who could get shot and not... You didn't have to see that to be, you know, even moved more than actually if you saw somebody actually get
shot. You mean film violence you're talking about? What, more of it now? We actually...
I'm talking about not so much film violence, because I love film violence. Did you ever see The Avengers? That movie's great.
Okay.
Then it's violence.
Yeah, yeah.
The plot, it should be not either or, it should be mixed. So it could be a better plot with more of the intellectual stuff mixed
yep.
with some of the reality.
Jim, are you talking about the death of the screenplay in modern Hollywood? Because I certainly agree with you there.
Down
exactly.
it goes. Well,
there you go.
Let us pick it up, Jim. You know, the two types there. You get your John
stars
Wayne, you
actors.
Get your Tom Cruise, stars and actors. But the big star type, I guess, and then you're describing this sort of anti-celebrity type. How do those two kinds of fame celebrity work? You got Brando, you got, I don't know, Sean Penn, you know, maybe even Ryan Gosling falls in that camp.
Mm-hmm. But one thing that Jim talked about that I want to address, he talks about how Tom Cruise and John Wayne, they're not actors. You know what? We divide people into stars and actors, and the actors are bigger stars than we want to recognize. And the stars are more conscious actors than we often give them credit for.
Mm.
There's an anecdote I tell in the book about John Wayne. Late in life, he said, yeah, when I was young, I got to work on the John Wayne thing. I practiced in front of a mirror. And I love that image of
John. But was he talking about screen acting there?
No, he was talking
about
the persona.
Or the whole acting project of making a star persona?
He was talking about getting the walk, getting the voice, getting the bearing. He, you know, he realized he had that in him, mm-hmm. and he sat down and he consciously made that perfect for the movies. And then later in his career, he starts working variations on it. So you get The Searchers, where he plays the dark side of John Wayne. But we have to be careful to make sure that we understand that these personas are often consciously, to some degree, arrived at and created. John Wayne was an actor. John Wayne, the persona, was his greatest performance.
Well, how are they arrived at? I mean, how do these – they're not gods. How do they know what persona is going to be that irresistible sort of culture-dominating shape?
Depends on the actor. You know – Fred Astaire arrives and he's instantly Fred Astaire on screen. I mean, his practice goes into dancing, but the persona is set. Clark Gable shows up and he's this, you know, young, unformed actor that everybody's going gaga for. The MGM publicity department starts putting him out on photo shoots where he's hunting and fishing and presenting him as a man's man, and he starts picking up those hobbies for real. There's a quote in the book from Joan Crawford where she says, sure, we used to use dialogue from our movies and use them in real life. The trick is not to lose your identity. They basically reverse engineered their personalities from their personas and somehow came up with something between the two, because think about it. They're young actors.
Mm-hmm.
They're young people.
Mm-hmm.
They're unformed. And
malleable.
All of a sudden, everybody knows who they are except them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about modern fame, celebrity, and the movies, the strange and ferocious power of celebrity, with Tiber, film critic for the Boston Globe, author of the big new book, Gods Like Us, on movie stardom and modern fame. Certainly comes in many, many flavors. Here's Ryan Gosling, 2011 action drama, Drive.
You want a glass of water?
Okay. Thanks.
So you just moved to LA?
No, I've been here for a while.
What do you do?
I drive.
Like a limo drive?
No, like for movies.
Oh. You mean all the car chases and stuff?
Yeah.
Is that dangerous?
It's only part-time.
Ryan Gosling, Carey Mulligan, Low Key, The Mystery Man. Different flavors, 1952, I Love Lucy, Lucille Ball, Desi Arnaz.
I'm gonna do a television show, that's all. And you cannot be on it.
Oh, Ricky, please, just let me do the commercial.
Nothing doing.
Why not?
You've never even been on a television show.
Well, maybe not, but I've watched them a lot.
There's a slight difference.
Oh, now, Ricky.
I'm sorry, honey, I gotta go now. I'll see you later.
No,
Ryan Gosling. Okay, all kinds of flavors. One of the things I found most interesting in your book, Ty, was you say that, you know, human beings, all of us, we're always, especially when we're young, we're creating identities.
Mm-hmm.
And that celebrities help us do that. How?
By acting, by appearing to present a coherent identity that may or may not be real, you know, but it is a construct and it's bigger than life.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems, you know, look at Ryan Gosling. He says so little in that scene,
mm-hmm.
but there's such mystery and it seems like there's a whole being there. And especially when you're young. But I think it's the human condition that we're unsure of our identities. And we want to try on different masks and we, mm-hmm. we're different people in different social settings. And we want to see what happens when, you know, when we act out different things, that's part of it.
And because they're so deliberately constructed, they're identifiable. We can take all of, you name it, Ryan Gosling, John Wayne, Lucille Ball, whoever you like.
Right.
Take that persona or pieces of those persona, put them together and make our own.
They're unique, they're discreet, and they present us with this myth of coherent identity that is really attractive because, you know, we want to feel like whole people.
The myth of coherent identity, but that myth is very potent.
Absolutely, and it's, you know, if anything, it's even more prevalent in our culture. You know, one of the through lines I talk about in the book is how a century of technology has gradually, step by step, mm-hmm. brought the tools of celebrity closer to the consumer, mm-hmm. closer to the audience. And with TV, you have in the 50s, you have it coming into the home, and each medium brings a different kind of star. All of a sudden, you have Lucille Ball, who'd been a genuine movie star, you know, never top rank in, you know, 30 years in the studio system. And here she's playing a housewife who wants to be a star. And that's the comedy. And then as we roll into the modern era, of course, we've got this wonderful tool called the internet that allows us to play at being at identity games ourselves. We can be whoever we want.
Constructed identities,
right,
for everyone.
And we can be a different person on Facebook than we are on Second Life, than we are on our Twitter feed, than we are, you know, in our email, than we are on Tumblr. We can put on as many masks as we want.
We're all in a way old-fashioned studios, I guess, many,
right,
people presenting a,
right,
constructed image to the world.
The means of celebrity has come down,
wow,
to the people.
Incredible. Laura in Somerville, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that in this modern age with Twitter and everything, that I find that the celebrities that don't have Twitter accounts to be by far the more interesting, the more I consider them to be stars as opposed to someone who's just famous. I feel like lots of people just become famous, you know, through the internet and all these different,
yeah,
ways, or through reality TV. And I don't consider them stars. They're just famous. People notice them, and I don't find them interesting. And the ones who kind of are just actors, and they're the most exciting. You know, like Brad Pitt and George Clooney and all these people. They're still the real stars.
So you want the mystery today? There's so many ways you can have exposure, but you don't want to see them in Us Weekly or I don't know where.
I mean, people clamor for them, for people like them to, you know, get a Twitter feed or a Facebook,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
and to a certain degree that would be fun. To a certain degree, like any of these other celebrities who have those accounts, you get to follow the minutiae of their lives, and I wouldn't say it wouldn't be fun, but you lose all the mystery, and
Laura, I know exactly what you mean. Thanks for that. Let us pick it up. Tom, I mean, there's a choice now. You can go for the mystery path. You can go the full exposure path, which has more celebrity potency.
Well, I think one of the things we've discovered now is in a world, in a culture of narcissism, when we can become celebrities or believe we can become celebrities ourselves in our own lives, what does that do to the traditional movie star? Well, in some cases, it allows them to be mocked, like Tom Cruise jumping on the couch.
Yeah,
but in other cases, and I think Laura's right, I think certain stars understand that they have to minimize how they play in this new world. We still have a need for that old-fashioned glamour, for those larger-than-life coherent identities, for the figures that seem to keep that old bargain of they're up there, we're down here, and they're special.
And then there's that whole breed, who's not a movie star at all, but maybe a celebrity. Here's Glozell Green, comedian, YouTube sensation. Her Cinnamon Challenge video features her trying to swallow a spoonful of straight cinnamon powder, has pulled 21 million views on YouTube.
So 150 kabillion people have been asking me to do the cinnamon challenge. All right, so here's the cinnamon. All right, here you go.
So she's just gagging and hacking and boom. I mean, what about it? I don't know if that's Kardashian level exactly, but we have lots of people online. You know, here's Joseph in Wisconsin. You know, what's the deal? Chaplin was brilliant for being a silent film actor. Brando was a brilliant actor. What do the Kardashians do? I mean, let alone a YouTube cinnamon, choker. Is famous for being famous a modern invention? Hefe says, what do these vacant people, Kardashians, do? Right on down. Here's Greg says, look, the ancient heroes wanted to make a name for themselves by achieving great deeds. Name one thing any Kardashian has done. Okay, Glozell choked down a spoonful of cinnamon. Is that the hurdle now, Ty?
Well, Glozell's an interesting case in that, you know, here's a woman who arrives in Hollywood. She wants to be a comedian and an actress, and she literally, you know, studies Jay Leno, and she wants to go for TV. I mean, she's like a thousand other people in L.A. who wants to become famous in the understood, accepted channels, and she puts stuff up on YouTube, and that's what takes off. And she's very smart and very canny. Mm-hmm. She realizes this is her audience. It's short-form video. It's, you know, you can watch it while you're eating your lunch.
And she's got a name all of a sudden.
And she's got a name, and she's conscious about doing it, but think about some of the people, some of the videos that have taken off on YouTube, like the laughing baby, or, you know.
People just falling off the back
know,
porch.
Antoine Dobson,
stars.
You know, you know, people who are on the news, or accidental net stars.
What about the Kardashians, for whom it's not at all accidental, but it's got really nothing to do with anything you can identify except that celebrity is there.
There have always been people who have been famous for being famous because they're sort of silly. They're pretty to look at, but they, you know, don't really do anything.
Like...
Oh, I mean, if you go back into the 20s when the tabloid culture really got started, there were, I mean, these are names that
we
nobody remembers anywhere,
now.
Like Peaches and Daddy Browning, which was a, you know, May-December romance that took up just front pages in the 20s. No, exactly, forgotten. And I guarantee you in 80 years,
who
no one will remember
recall?
What has changed. Here's what has changed is the points of distribution. We have a voracious gossip industry of magazines and TV shows and websites that have to be filled all the time. And it's not just, you know, a handful of newspapers. It is just thousands of points of dissemination.
Does it dilute the power of those celebrities to engage with our identity, with our internal conversation about ourselves? Are people now building themselves modeled on the Kardashians?
I think that there's a certain part of the culture, and I talk about this in the book, and I think it's kind of a danger in that we're wrapped up in this 24/7 culture of celebrity where being seen is what matters, is the marker of value more than what you do. And I think that is taking over the culture in a dangerous way, in a way that really needs to be talked about.
Let's talk about Robert writes to us on Facebook. He says, celebrity worship is the tumor eating away at the bottom of body of Western society.
But we always need people to, as I've said, we need people to explain things to us, to articulate identity. But what's happening now, and I don't know if it's a tumor, I think it's something that needs to be discussed, is that being seen is all that matters, so that people do emulate the Kardashians in that, you know, fine, what do you have to do to be seen? Put out a sex tape, put out a YouTube.
But if there's no achievement or even image of achievement, even, you know, persona constructed around the idea of achievement.
Yeah, you're in trouble.
Maybe then Robert's onto something.
You're in trouble. And I think we do, we have this binocular vision where we do recognize achievement and we do hold that to a higher level. And yeah, we mock the Kardashian has become this short-term adjective for fame without substance.
Yeah, well.
So maybe that's her persona.
They're rich. Kira in Worcester, Massachusetts. Kira, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting conversation. I'm 28, and I'm more in light of substance. So what I tend to focus on is what's going to sustain my thinking. So I follow more of the old school Hollywood format. So Helen Mirren, Ellen Burstyn, Meryl Streep, Vivian Leigh. I tend to like celebrity in the sense of you can watch a film that was made 20 years ago and it still has relevance today. So I tend to stay away from the reality shows, the sake of being famous.
We hear that. I'm right with you. But let me ask you, when you look back at those older, Helen Mirren, how fantastic, of course, Meryl Streep and more, what is your relationship with them? What are you using them for? Are you in part, working out your identity through their persona?
Well, I guess it's they really inspire me to strive in terms of doing things, more or less a mission. So, for example, when I'm looking at the history work of Meryl Streep, I think every role that she takes is very pivotal in trying to portray a voice to a story that needs to be told in society. So I'm inspired by that. For a good example that you just recently played on the air was a clip of Sophie's Choice, which is an amazing film.
Yep.
And the sad reality of it is that some people in today's society will know a Kim Kardashian versus a Meryl Streep and haven't even seen that film, which is something that speaks voice to an issue that affected millions.
Absolutely.
I guess I'm more driven that way.
Yeah, and it is a shame when the sort of majesty and insight of that drama gets disassociated from the celebrity and you've just got the image. Kira, I'm very happy for your call. Thanks so much. Let's get one more. Montpelier, Vermont. Ed is calling. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Talking about how an actor can create a personality that's so powerful that can affect enormous numbers of people. When I was a teenager in the 50s, there was a bit actor who appeared on a number of dramas, and he usually had very, very small parts, almost virtually insignificant, and usually played a tough guy or a thug. Mm. But every time this guy was on screen, everybody else disappeared. He was such an electric presence, and I immediately recognized. I thought,
reveal, who was it?
This guy's going to be a real star one day. It was James Dean.
Okay.
Ah, yes.
And you saw it. And there it was. You could see it even before he became that big figure. Ed, let us look at that. What about it? Can you recognize who's going to be that icon from their first sort of, two-bit appearance?
Again, it depends on the star. Some people arrive fully formed. Or you can see what they're going to. Some of us for the last, 5, 6, 7 years, I've had our eye on Joseph Gordon-Levitt. When I saw him in
Looper, he's in.
He's in Looper now. He was in Inception. What did I see him in that made? Brick, the high school noir.
Yeah.
And I said, this guy is somebody special. He had a kid role in a TV sitcom for years, but all of a sudden, he's got something special, and you want to keep your eye on him. Some people toil for years and finally are discovered. Humphrey Bogart was in Hollywood for over a decade playing sniveling rats, playing villains, playing the guy who beats up the girl. Mm-hmm. And he was nobody's idea of a hero. And he had to sort of age like scotch or firewood before he was discovered in High Sierra and the Maltese Falcon in 1941.
Great. Age like scotch or firewood and maybe you will emerge as the great one. Michelle, in Lebanon, New Hampshire. Michelle, you're on the air.
Hey there. Well, this is terrifically entertaining. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to toss out the point that I think some, gods like us, I would have to say that I think that David Bowie is not like other people.
Hmm.
When I was 10 years old, I saw him with Bing Crosby and the, singing the Drummer Boy, and that was it. That was it for me. I'm like, it shifted everything.
The fork in the road.
Now I'm in my early 40s, and I'm a physician, and I'm science-minded and data-driven and all those other things.
Yeah.
But I still am convinced that there's no way he's like us. And
he is, in fact, an alien.
If I was in a tent in Africa and Audrey Hepburn handed me a cup of tea, I would know that that's not a normal situation. And I think it's the same as if I would meet David Bowie, which I never have. But I just know, you know, even though I know he's a human being, I know for a fact he's not like us.
Dr. Michelle, you are fantastic. What a great note here. How about it, Ty? The doctor is in. She knows all the science. And still, when it comes to those who send her, they're not like us.
Absolutely. And I talk about how we need these people, how, you know, they explain things to us. Sometimes it's just pure charisma. Sometimes you just look at somebody and go, who the heck is that? They're different. They're unusual. They're putting out some kind of energy. Bowie's interesting. I spent a bit of time in the book going away from movie stars and talking about how in the 60s and 70s, pop music took over a lot of the star dynamic. And we got
Rolling Stones, Beatles,
the counterculture generation got a lot of those archetypes out of pop music. And Bowie's sort of the first notable, what I call the first notable post-Warhol star, in that he's about consciously putting on masks and changing. You know, when he was in his peak in the 70s, he was a different guy every year. And that was part of the attraction.
It's
who's
the power
be?
Of personal theater. And
right.
We as a species seem just made to eat it up. There seems to be no end to it. Or is there? We're almost out of time here. But is there a point at which all the media sort of outstrip our appetite and we don't want celebrities anymore, or not?
I think we will always want celebrities. We will always want people who seem bigger than us. At the same time, I think we are getting fascinated by the mirror, by this technological mirror that we can stare into all day long, holding it in our hands and putting on various masks and explaining ourselves to the world.
And there's Mindshare, lost to the celebrity, or we are the celebrity in our own little mini-me tent with the Facebook image. Tiber, terrific. The book is Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. Film critic for the Boston Globe. Excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ty, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Tom. Really appreciate it.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast right there, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today, all you celebrities in the making out there, and everybody else. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.